Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Minjin Lee.
Thank you so much for having me.
Author of Pachinko. Could you tell us the story of Pachinko?
Absolutely. So we have a 16-year-old illiterate girl from a tiny little islet off the southern tip of Korea. And back then it was only one Korea. And she falls in love with a really charismatic, powerful man. And she becomes pregnant by him. She learns that he's married, and of course he can't marry her. So she rebuffs his advances to become his mistress. Later on, a tubercular minister comes to stay at a boarding house which her mother runs, does not own, and they nurse him back to health. He offers to marry her, and then she moves to Japan. And hence we begin the story of Sanja and her three generations that she creates in Japan.
And it is a big, sprawling family saga.
Yeah.
And it is a family saga of somehow how shame reverberates through generations, being an immigrant in an occupying land, are themes which we can explore. But also I wanted to talk about home. You start the book with a quotation mm-hmm. about home. And talk to me a little bit about that and in relation to the book.
I start the book with the epigraph from Charles Dickens about home and how it's a powerful word and it conjures incredibly important emotional things in our hearts. And I guess I think I connected with that, even though I'm not Korean Japanese, and obviously I didn't go to Japan and live there for my entire life. I visited for 4 years, which isn't very long. And I think that maybe connected with me because I am an immigrant to America, and I moved to America when I was 7.5 years old. My entire life is in America, and I'm an American citizen now. But at the same time, I know that there's another place that was home, which is obviously gone because that was 1976 Seoul, South Korea. So whenever I go back to Seoul, it's not 1976, and that place is gone. However, I do think that it does still conjure so many emotional things in me.
I was going to say, because my first thought, which you also just expressed, that home is a time and not a place.
Yeah. Mm. And it's also the people who were there who may be gone now. And who obviously are no longer 7.5. Like, mm-hmm. my elementary school friends are all gone now because they're adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also for your parents, that was more home than it was for you. And yet, I imagine, like most kids, you know, your parents sort of spring to life for the purpose of you. You know? You know what I mean? And your sort of child understanding of your parents.
Their only purpose is to procreate me.
They were waiting, and then, you know. And sort of your concept of home in America is maybe not their concept of home as well. It's not necessarily a shared...
That's absolutely true, particularly for both my parents, because both my parents don't come from Seoul. My father comes from the northern region of Korea, which is now called North Korea. So when he was growing up, it was just the northern part. It was Wonsan, a port city. He was a wealthy landowner's son. And then at 16, he lost his entire family after the war, and he became a war refugee. And my mother is from the very, very southern part of Korea, which is now South Korea, and she's from Busan. And she grew up in a very big house where her father, a Presbyterian minister, ran an orphanage for war orphans. So her background couldn't be more different than my father's. So when they think of home, I don't think it's the home that I think of 1976 Seoul.
Yeah, no. And I imagine your siblings are slightly different as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the reason why we're always walking around kind of lost. Everybody.
Yes, I mean, and I, you know, as you can hear, we are in London. I am not from London. and feeling like an outsider mm-hmm. is not something I feel here very much anymore, although recent politics has made me feel that I could be viewed as something representative of something that I don't feel I am. But that feeling, I think for Sunja and her family, exacerbated by carried familial shame from her father's family. He had a cleft palate, and etc. Through to her shame in bearing a child out of wedlock. Through to, I think, her shame at viewing her marriage as a duty.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
I think what really strikes me is that as I get older, I realize that all of us carry certain things that we're ashamed of, which I guess we shouldn't be ashamed of. And we think of them now as immutable characteristics. Your genetics, your race, your religion, or the people that you are put into a group with. And I think this entire world is walking around with people feeling like they're somehow misfits, when in fact they're just who they are. Depending upon the context, and unfortunately the nation where you live, those immutable characteristics become more pronounced. And if you happen to be in the tribe or the wrong tribe, then you're in trouble.
Yes, if you're the occupied or the...
hated.
Yeah. Yeah, because nobody ever, you know, nobody ever took over another country because they liked them so much.
Right. And as a matter of fact, you know what I mean? There's usually a very clear philosophy that's usually explicit and written that explains why that group has to be hated.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens everywhere.
Yes. Everywhere.
Everywhere.
And every colonizing or grasping or overtaking anybody has done that.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any colonizer, any, you know, nothing. And none of us are immune from that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we walk around with that shame, and yet our luck, we don't seem to be... It is literally just the other side of your luck. And that we don't seem to not attach to. You know
no,
I mean?
As a matter of fact, I think we always walk around thinking, why me? Why do I have this thing that I don't want? Because the world says I'm not supposed to want it. But very rarely do we walk around saying, oh, I'm really glad that I have nice colored eyes or good shaped ears.
Yeah,
right.
I'm no less deserving.
Right.
I mean, I'm no more or less, you know, it really has no, I didn't have any choice in any of this.
Yeah, if you have to be born in a mud hut in Tibet today, as a disabled child.
Mm-hmm.
Why him and why not me?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to ask that question if you're really honest.
And it's not as though, I mean, obviously it was important to ask these questions at every moment in time. But now when we pretend to globalization, when we pretend to connectivity, it seems all the grosser and all the more important to ask that question of, yeah, they're refugees. Stop.
There are 65 million refugees who are walking the globe right now. And nobody wants them. And there are nations where there are plenty of spaces and resources to accept them, to integrate them, and actually to desire them. There isn't an economist in the world who would disagree with me when we believe that to have a stronger team and a stronger nation, a more vibrant economy, we need to have new entrants who have a different gene pool. So when we actually close our doors, we actually hurt ourselves because we're afraid.
Unfortunately, I don't think you and I are going to solve that, but we should try a little,
well,
I suppose.
Actually, I do think that we're solving it by resisting, by stating it. I think that it's amazing to me that we could have this conversation, that we're allowed to in this country. That's an enormous freedom that does not exist elsewhere. So I think even as America and, let's say, the United Kingdom isn't perfect in every sense, the fact that we can have this discussion, the fact that things can be printed and circulated, are available for people to agree or disagree, that's democracy in action, and that's what we really fight for.
And that speaks directly to the not counting our luck.
Yeah.
Why us? Well, since we were lucky enough to have it, I think we're sort of duty-bound to do something with it.
Oh, I think that moral compulsions to take the talents and the opportunities given to us and to raise them, that is a philosophical value that most of the Enlightenment was trying to increase.
Yeah, propagate.
Absolutely,
yes. Yeah. Yes. Send it out there like missionaries.
Right.
You know?
I actually think that is really what we educated people have to do. Mm-hmm. To speak out.
Mm. Getting back to this family, though, because it's a family just like a family, like everyone's family.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that shame, there is a wider cultural context for it. But in each generation, this, you know, in the way that we all do, despite our desires not to be like our parents, we do end up being like our parents, you know, probably especially because we desire not to be, and that we're blind to the ways that we are. And that shame, despite the wider context, it keeps them all from loving each other as well as they could.
Sure.
Or allowing themselves closeness within the family. Why do you think that it manifests itself in that way?
I think if you're trying to cover yourself because you think there's something wrong with you, then I think that you'll always have that shield, that covering, which prevents intimacy between two people. Like, true contact, true intimacy requires vulnerability. And it's really hard to be vulnerable when you feel like there's something wrong. Like, the distinction between shame and guilt. Guilt is when you is the emotion that you feel when you do something wrong. Shame is when you feel like there's something wrong with you. And in that case, when the outer society is saying there's something wrong with you actually being the way you were born, whether it's your religion or your ethnicity or because you have a learning disability, it could be any of those things. Depending upon where you are, and in Japan, it's highly intolerant of people who are different. It's a great country. Everybody should visit. The food is spectacular. The level of craftsmanship is, I think, world class, truly world class. That said, it runs on a very strong philosophy where people have to conform to a very strict social norm. And I think coming from the West, where I really believe that heterogeneity is actually a strength, it's always sort of surprising to me when people who are sick, who have parents who are divorced, like, that's considered something very horrible. Let's say if you're gay, all those things, and they're immutable. They're mm-hmm. things that you didn't choose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's judged upon. And people who are in certain camps like that are excluded. I find that to be really hard, especially because I am an American and I think that that's not okay.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. I was just doing some Googling around the book and whatever, and I came upon a review in the Japan Times.
Sure.
And it was a very positive review. And tried to be, you know, it's some of it was carefully worded in terms of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And how Koreans were treated. But it was hysterical that it was right next to an article about a hashtag that was trending
mm-hmm.
in Japan called Gaijin Confession Friday.
Wow.
Gaijin being the word for
right.
outsider,
foreigner,
or stranger, uh-huh. foreigner. And it was things like, I don't like udon. And that it was confessional, in the true confessional sense of feeling like even saying it out loud would be to admit otherness.
Right.
You know, when you're already other, you know. I thought it was absolutely hysterical. Well, and odd. You know?
Well, and I also think it's kind of funny because the hashtags that are trending about, like, Gaijin confessions is that I think people from the West who go to Asia really police themselves very strongly against saying things that are culturally imperialistic. And that's because when you're from the West, you know that things are supposed to be culturally relative. If that country believes in genital mutilation, you're not supposed to say that's bad. And that's because anthropology and the Enlightenment has somehow declared that we can't be more culturally imperialistic. I guess I have to side with the sense that there are moral rules that I believe in. I disagree with genital mutilation. I do. I believe that women should be educated. I do. So
crazy radical.
I know. I know. And I believe that we should have social safety nets for those who can't take care of themselves. Makes me a communist. I mean, I don't know. So all these ideas, I think, yes, it is definitely from the West. But I think as long as I acknowledge that it's from the West, then I want to say that I believe that those ideas are better. Mm. I will say that. Mm-hmm. So that's my Gaijin confession.
Gaijin confession.
That's right.
I wanted to talk to you. One of the things that I also agreed with the Japan Times review was that it was the book is extraordinarily rich in detail and scrupulously researched. Tell me a bit about why you chose this topic, how you researched it, etc.
I got the idea for the book in 1989. I started writing it in 1996. I wrote an entire manuscript based on academic research, and that book was finished in 2003. It was a terrible book. It was not a novel, so I didn't send it out to an agent because I figured that no one's going to want to read it. But I was happy that I wrote it, but I felt like I didn't have the chops for it. And then in 2007, after my first novel was published, my husband got a job. And then it was a good job in Tokyo, and he's a very nice man, and I couldn't replace him easily. So
it would be more annoying to replace him than move to Japan.
Right. No, you have to do a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah. I see.
So I ended up...
Due diligence.
Yes. I ended up in Tokyo in 2007 in August, and I decided that I would research that topic for my second book that I had written, the second manuscript that I had written. And I started interviewing dozens upon dozens of Korean Japanese. I visited the locations. There wasn't a thing that I couldn't do. And I realized that the reason why that second book was so bad is because it wasn't a novel. It wasn't a history book. It was almost like a pamphlet in an 18th century sense, like Common Sense by Thomas Paine. It was something, I was trying to argue a thing. It was a very victims-oriented, self-justifying, very self-righteous kind of book. Because when I ended up talking to everybody, and I started to really listen to everybody, I learned that they don't see themselves as victims. They see the social norm to be a very bad thing. However, their attitude is, we're going to be here, we like it here. And some of the Japanese are incredibly great, and therefore we're going to make a life here. We don't want to go back. We can't go back. There is no back. And consequently, we want to have the right to choose. That is our legacy. We have the right to choose. So now there are three kinds of Korean Japanese in Japan. You can have a North Korean identified Korean Japanese. You can have a South Korean identified Korean Japanese. You can have a Japanese naturalized citizen Korean Japanese. And that means that they have three different legal statuses. Wow. You have a South Korean passport holder. You have a North Korean card holder, which means you can't leave the country. Mm-hmm. You have to stay there. Or you have a Japanese citizen, but you're ethnically Korean. What is still true today with all three groups is that no one in Japan would ever think that they are Japanese. Ever. Hmm. Not in a true sense. So if you married somebody who's ethnically Korean, it's something that people would talk about. They would see that as something that you have done to contaminate your family line. Mm. And that's still true today. Mm. No matter what your education, pedigree, bank statement, it doesn't matter.
It's just considered true.
It's just considered true because your blood has been changed.
Mm. And yet, I do know from Japanese friends, you know, like the Korean soap operas, the Korean pop stars, mm-hmm. you know, they're mad over it.
Absolutely.
But I also know, okay, take America. That is sort of, you know, from slaves, appropriate culture as, you know, pleasure. I hope it's a first path to change. Who can say?
Actually, I'm willing to say that it's not a path to change at all. Mm. I think it will never change. And I've thought about this a lot because I started off from the point of view of people do change. The Japanese do not change. Mm. The narrative and the philosophy in Japan is that there has to be a true Japanese. So they may be kind, the laws may change, but they really believe in the purity aspect of it. And Japan's not the only country. So, for example, it's kind of like saying, if you like a soap star, it's almost like saying, I like Oprah Winfrey. She's awesome. It doesn't mean that you want African-Americans to live in your neighborhood. And that's exactly what happens in Japan.
Yeah.
So the rise of Hallyu, this whole idea of soft culture of South Korea being popular, we get this argument all the time. And yet their attitude is, we don't want that kid in our school. We don't want to live in their neighborhood. They can't rent from our building. We don't want to marry anybody who's Korean. And there's only 600,000 Korean Japanese in Japan.
Mm.
So I think their attitude is eventually they'll sort of die out or get married or marry in or pass or leave.
Those are the options.
Those are the options.
And that, I mean, it sounds like you know, had a very nice time, like an interesting and an amazing time. But was that sort of a palpable thing for you? And did that feel different than being Korean American?
Oh, it's so different than being a Korean American. And as a matter of fact, I had a wonderful time in Japan. Mm. My husband is half Japanese. My son is a quarter Japanese. So I'm the last person who would ever say, oh, the Japanese are terrible people. It's nonsense. It's almost like trying to blame white people today for slavery that occurred.
Mm.
The problem that I have is all the denial in history books. So what ends up happening is when you meet young Japanese kids, they're awesome and they're so sweet and innocent and they really want to be good citizens in the world. And when they travel outside Japan, especially in Asia, they're always scratching their heads like, why do people dislike us?
What did I ever do?
I know what, and the thing is,
I didn't do anything.
I know, and the thing is, they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
They're completely innocent of the crimes that occurred in the Pacific War. However, because I don't understand it, they're always thinking like, oh, well, the Chinese, they don't like us. The Koreans, they don't like us. And it's insane. It's like asking a black person in South Africa, and the white people are going, oh, the blacks hate us. Or asking Germans, like,
us.
Oh, the Jews must hate us.
It's
like, so it's the ahistorical, ignorant absence of context that I really take issue with. But do I have a problem with the Japanese people? Of course not. Yeah.
Hmm. And yet in America, because I know we're of similar ages, you youngster. And there was always, I mean, I just, you know, growing up in New York, one of the stereotypes is, you know, hardworking Japanese. And that really goes for any immigrant community. That's generally the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't work to get here to be considered, you know, other and less than, unless you're willing to, you know, and thrive.
Right.
Unless you are hardworking and etc. But it's sort of a different stereotype.
Oh, it's completely different than the model minority. It's
totally
different than the model minority, which says that everybody's hardworking and clean-cut and they add to the prosperity of the country. Obviously, I take contention with any kind of stereotype. However, in Asia, and especially in Japan, it's really weird because the Chinese and the Koreans are seen as criminal. I know. Lazy. Aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Aggressive. They're seen as troublemakers. They complain too much. So when I was living in Tokyo, I was able to blithely forget this personally for most of the time, because I was living in this kind of expat bubble. My apartment was paid for by my husband's company. My son's schooling was paid for by my husband's company. And people that I spoke, that I was with socially, they all spoke English.
Mm.
But then once in a while, things would happen, and then I would remember. So, for example, I was living in this lovely apartment that was paid for. And one day, the toilet above us started to leak. It's like a real New York story. I pointed this out to the management company and they repaired it, but they had to open the ceiling. And when I noticed that the ceiling, that the material was not dry. So I called them after it was repaired and I said, before they close it, it really has to dry properly. You can't just close it right away. So I'll stay home the next day from work so that they can come and dry it because they have all these powerful fans and things. Because I'd done this before somewhere else. Because, you know,
it's
I'm from New York. Because I'm from New York and also because I'm neurotic. I'm neurotic and I think, oh, we don't want to have mold because people get sick, blah, blah, blah. And then the managing agent came back and he called me and said, you know, you Koreans are always complaining. And wow. I was in shock. I was so in shock because I thought, oh, I thought I was just being a good neurotic citizen. It's your property. It's not even mine. Like, if there's a mold problem, I can leave. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with
it.
I'm out of here. But it was the first thing that this Japanese managing agent turned to, which was, I must be complaining. I must be making trouble for him. I must be being difficult. And that was such a great example for me of, oh, that's how you see me. So even when I forget who I am, mm-hmm. you haven't forgotten.
Yeah.
You haven't forgotten the list of terrible, immoral characteristics that supposedly my tribe has.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. It is oddly for a family site, it really is page turning.
Oh,
you want to know, you want to spend time with these people through, is it eight decades,
four generations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely lovely book.
Thank you.
But I also want to know, before we go, because I did not know you as a writer prior to this.
Sure.
So please tell me if you could tell us a bit about Free Food for Millionaires, which was okay. a best-selling book of yours prior to this.
Oh, that book is part of a trilogy. Mm. So the Pachinko is the second book of my trilogy of Koreans in Japan. So the trilogy, they're not linked by characters, but they're linked in theme. So the first book is called Free Food for Millionaires, and it is a novel about the Koreans in America. And it's about a young girl, Casey Han. She comes from New York. Her parents run and manage a dry cleaning shop in Manhattan. She lives in Queens. She goes to a very fancy college in Princeton. And then after she graduates, she has to decide, will she become an upper middle class professional or will she do whatever she's supposed to do with her life? And it's about that decision making process. And it's a very fun read. Again, it's a community novel. I design my books very much like the books that I loved, which are 19th century novels. However, I wanted to have very modern sentences. So in terms of being a writer, I worked very hard to figure out how do you write a 19th century novel that's well plotted and really interesting and you want to keep reading, but then how do you write sentences that are really clean, that people aren't intimidated? Because if you read George Eliot, and she is my favorite writer, it isn't the kind of sentence for every person. So I wanted to get that every man sentence and use an old structure. So I think that's my excuse for having taken a long time to write two books.
Okay.
That's my story. I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just sticking to it. Okay, so Free Food for Millionaires, Pachinko, and you said there's a trilogy.
Yes.
Talk to me about what's next.
So my next book is called American Hagwon, and a Hagwon, H-A-G-W-O-N, is the Korean word for a cram school. So in South Korea today, a child is, let's say, 11 years old. He will be sent to a hagwon after school. So let's say school ends at 3 or 4 o'clock. The kid goes there from 4 o'clock and stays there until midnight 6 days a week. And so if you want to understand why South Korea has scores that are the best in the world in terms of math, sciences, and English, it's because they're studying that many more hours. They have essentially two schools per day.
Wow.
And they also have an additional day of school, unlike America's five. So it's quite extensive. The kids don't go home in the evening, except just to sleep. The parents have to subscribe to a bento service or a lunch service, dinner service, and snacks. And it's incredibly costly for families. So families often spend a third of their income on education for children. What's interesting now is that these hagwons are going all over the world. And it's not just Koreans who go to them. Because in this age of anxiety,
yes.
all the parents are thinking, I guess my kid has to know German and Mandarin and know how to code and play weird sports. All those things are going on. And what I'm writing about is the role of education for Koreans around the world. Mm. So I've been interviewing Koreans on the planet to understand this hagwon phenomenon, and that'll be the third book.
Mm.
And then I'm going to quit.
So you say. Somehow I don't believe
it. I don't know, I might. I just
you
might.
Never know.
Never know.
And why? Why would you quit?
Oh, it's so hard. Mm. Like, writing is not easy for me. I have friends who can produce a book every 2 years, and they're really good books, or every 3 years. And for me, it's like I really labor so much in structure, point of view, and in the work itself. I probably make it more hard for myself than I need to, but I want the experience for the reader to be really pleasurable. Like, I never want you to sort of stop thinking about... I want you to just, like, forget the writing and just, like, be in the story. And that actually takes a lot of chiseling. Like, there's so much chiseling that has to happen. And I don't think I do it easily.
So?
Right.
That's not my problem.
That's not your problem. It's my problem.
Why are you denying me? Because it's hard for you. I don't understand.
Right. No, you're right. I really think that books have to be entertaining and they have to be edifying. And it's that intersection that I find really hard to do. So the next book is very important to me philosophically, but in no way should the reader feel like it should be philosophically, you know, tiresome. Like, reading philosophy is so boring. I mean, I read a lot of, it's so tiresome. In the same way, reading history, as much as I love it, can be very tedious. And when you read this book, you're going to end up walking away with an enormous amount of information, but you didn't learn it in any painful way, and I didn't want it to be.
Yeah, yes, yes. And yes, it is difficult to do, but it is a worthy endeavor.
I think so.
Well, and we thank you for undertaking it.
And it sounds so grandiose when I say it that way, but I think that's why it's so hard for me. So I wish I could write easier books for me. And also maybe, like, if I had more talent, it'd be easier. I don't know. Like, well, I'm working on it.
But I think that you gave the example of having written the history that's inside Pachinko prior to writing Pachinko. And I think that it sounds like it's a process of partial digestion that... You
yes.
have to fully digest all of that information in order to then take the time to fictionalize it and find your way into that.
Well, that's exactly the right metaphor. And if I could extend your metaphor, is that after you digest it, you have to metabolize it to make it fiction. Because you don't want to write a history book. Because that should be a history book. And this is not a history book. But it should feel really natural. And the thing that I think is part of my resistance to the political climate for me is that I need to change your heart and your mind. And I think that happens really through intimacy. And the relationship between a reader and a text is very intimate. So when you're in, you're in.
Well, and it sounds to me also what you're saying is that there has to be trust.
Absolutely.
And trust
means that I didn't mess around.
This is genuine. Mm-hmm. And this is beyond plausible. It is genuine and not alternate facts.
And right. And I could, if you point to me a chapter and verse, I can tell you exactly where they came from. I can tell you the treaty. I can tell you the interview that I had. I can footnote it if you needed to. However, it shouldn't feel like that in the reading experience. The reading experience should just be like, I want to be in. I don't want to leave.
Yes. Right. Yes.
But I kind of think, I don't know if I have more than three of those in my body.
Excellent. Well, waiting for Hagwan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you for having me.